time for another episode of The Cultural Hall. This is episode 106, where we visit with Nicole Hardy, Confessions of a Latter-day Virgin. It is me, Richie T.
Not Confessions of an Anxious White Virgin.
No, that book forthcoming.
So this girl, she wrote this book, kind of her coming out party. Say, I used to be a virgin, and now I'm not a virgin, and I'm not...
And I'm not Mormon. Yeah, she talks all about kind of sexuality within the church. We get into it pretty well.
You know, and a lot of people kind of decide, you know, their sexuality defines who they are.
Right.
So this is one of those things. It's like being a Mormon and being sexually active don't go hand in hand. And so...
Yeah, being a single Mormon.
Right, there you go. Single Mormon, there you go.
Or married.
Or married, whatever.
Right? Who's with me? Nobody?
Hey, okay. Hey, I'm having sex with my wife, and I feel terribly guilty about it.
Right, and there's a lot of that, and we talk about some of that as well.
Interesting, very interesting.
But she's great. It's on the phone. It's Nicole Hardy.
It's on the phone. Oh, good. Yeah. People love those phone call ones.
Right?
Yeah.
Do they not?
I don't know.
Is that what that means?
I don't know.
You don't care for them?
No, I think they're fine.
Well, you hate them?
No.
Is that what you were trying to
say?
I
hate the ones where it's just Richie T.
You hate the one...
I just get bored with you sometimes. I'm kidding.
It's never just me.
I know. You.
I'm always talking to someone
That'd
else.
That'd be fun. Yeah, you should do your own podcast. Today we're interviewing myself.
What do I think about this?
So you got an email there?
Yeah, I was just trying to think of which one I wanted to share. This is interesting. Let me share this with you. We'll call this from Derek.
All right.
This one from Derek. That's not his real name, so don't think that you know who Derek is.
Oh, okay, because I know a Derek.
Richie says, now hold on a sec. Just Joni commented on your story about the timid sister. This is from last week's, the October 28th articles of news, where we talk about the wallflower story. Just Joni commented on your story about the timid sister wanting to socialize by saying that we exclude a lot of people, we meaning Mormons. I'd like to hear a lot more on that. Why as a culture do we do that? I remember thinking when I was younger that people from other faiths didn't pray right, so they weren't good enough or as strong enough of believers. And we teach people how to, quote, correctly pray. I did that as a missionary about 10 years ago. I think a main underlying issue for me was that anyone else's faith was just incomplete. I looked at everyone as a missionary prospect, someone to be helped, not as a peer or potential friend, or more importantly, someone who I could learn a lot about faith and being a believer from. Since being excommunicated, I've had my eyes opened to many things regarding our faith. I still faithfully attend, and I hope to be reinstated sometime in the future, but I think there is much to be explored regarding the exclusivity of the church. I think there is an actual cultural shift taking place, and it has been taking place for a while, from the top down along these lines. More questions I'd like to hear discussed is how do we further challenge the cultural exclusivity of the church? On a micro level, what is it that keeps people from challenging their own thoughts on being exclusive? Does the fundamental nature of our beliefs promote this thinking, i.e. being a temple recommend holder, being in a leadership calling an award? If I'm missing a conversation that happened in the past on the podcast, then I'd be interested in seeking it out. I like you. And I like the podcast, says Derek. I'd be interested in collaborating with you in any way that benefits you or the podcast in the future. My wife and I are hoping to do some awesome things next year. Perhaps we could discuss them with you when they happen. Thank you, Derek.
I don't remember that story. Can you?
The wallflower. I actually shared it as part of my lesson in Sunday school yesterday. It's a narrative from Mormon Mommy blogs. You can find a link to it on the articles of news for October 28th, where essentially it just is a woman that says, you know, growing up, she'd hang out with her friends at the dance.
Yeah.
And she was a little shy.
Yes.
And she would stay towards the wall and all the other girls would get asked to dance. And,
yes.
And then she wouldn't. And then she feels similarly in the ward where... You know, she kind of hangs out after church hoping to be able to have, you know, some meaningful conversation with people and doesn't, you know, have that opportunity because everyone, you know, is either in too much of a hurry or doesn't think that that person needs to be talked to or anything like that. So,
yeah, it's tough because you think you get over it in middle school, high school. You think, you know what, I left it behind. And then you see some of those things happen to you again. in your adult life. And you're like, I thought I was beyond this. I thought we were beyond this. And it can happen.
I don't think that I thought it was ever that was behind us. Like, a huge example to me was a couple of years ago, I had my 10-year high school reunion.
Yeah.
And I thought, cool, everyone's going to be grown up. We're not in high school anymore. Right. Everyone's just going to be like, hey, you're from the same high school and we went to school together. I don't really remember you. How are you?
How's your life? It's good to see you.
And that was not the case at all. Everyone that night split into their groups of the people that they hung out with. And it wasn't like they were being mean or nasty to people.
It's just what they're comfortable with.
Yeah. And I think that that perpetuates in church wards, in work groups, in everything.
It's funny because we still have these social constructs even as we get older. And you think people mature, they don't. I don't know if this has happened to you. I remember I was at the mall once, and I saw
I've never been at the mall.
Never been at the mall. Okay. This is a City Creek. Huh. And I was downtown.
So the Lord's Mall.
So a girl that I went to elementary school, middle school, and high school with, hadn't seen her in years, and I saw her walking, and I think we made eye contact. I went to go say hello. She diverted her eyes and then started walking the other way.
Really?
And I was just like, oh, she didn't want to have that conversation where I said, where we do this, you know, the stupid small talk. Hey, how you doing? Haven't seen you in a while.
Huh.
You know those conversations.
No, I fully engage in them.
I was ready to engage her, and I saw her divert her eyes and just...
She wanted nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
Did you try and date her?
No, I never
nothing
dated
like that?
Her.
Nothing weird
nothing.
And awkward?
Nothing like that.
Date her friend?
Nope. And it wasn't even awkward. It was just like, I guess she didn't want to have that conversation today.
Did you yell at her?
Nope.
I was coming to talk to you!
I was coming to talk to you, but fine. Be that way. But it's just so funny how people can be that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, you know who I am. I know who you are. Let's not avoid this conversation.
Right.
You know how people kind of do that? You're like, I know you and you know me,
right.
But you still
are. Who are you? What are we talking about? It is an interesting topic, though, Derek, and something we should get into in a future episode of the Cultural Hall.
It's part of our culture.
So if you want to weigh in on it, you can always email us, richie@theculturalhall.com, or go to the contact us at theculturalhall.com.
Or step on a scale.
Yeah, stupid.
Okay.
Thank you for the weigh-in pun. if you feel like you have some sort of professional outlook on that, if maybe that's something that you are specifically good at, or if you've just experienced a lot, share us your story. We would love to share it in a future episode of the Cultural Hall. It's now time for the second and third block.
Ding ding ding!
It's Confessions of a Latter-day Virgin. It's Nicole Hardy coming back in the second and third block.
Running a small business today can be difficult enough. Imagine all the work you have to do to market it. Imagine the hours you put in to create promotional materials for it. Now, imagine a partner that can help you with all of that and more. Imagine Lennon Design. Lennon Design is your partner in business when you need a professional look at a price you can afford. Whether it's websites, advertising media, promotional materials, and more, Lennon Design can help you promote your business. When you need creative, affordable designs, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
It's time now for the second block of the Cultural Hall, and joining me on the phone from, I'm presuming, based on what time you requested to speak to me, the West Coast, it's Nicole Hardy. How are you?
I'm great. Yeah, I'm leaving Los Angeles today on my way to Salt Lake City for a reading.
Oh, well. It'll be good to have you here in the great state of Utah, within the Zion Curtain.
Thank you.
She says reading because she's going to be talking to people about her book, Confessions of a Latter-day Virgin, a memoir. And that's what we're going to talk to you about right now. First of all, tell me a little bit about yourself, Nicole. Born a member of the LDS Church?
Yeah, my parents were both converts. Well, my dad converted when he was something like 17. He came from a pretty abusive and neglectful family, and he found the church and went off to Brigham Young University, where he met my mother, whose family converted just before she turned 8. So She also made her way to Brigham Young University. My parents married there. My brother and I were born in the Bay Area, and I grew up mostly in Seattle. And I was a devout member of the Mormon Church until I was 35, when I made my way elsewhere.
Okay, so you just leapt through 35 years of time. We got to go back a little bit.
I did. No, we'll go back. So
let me ask you this: How did your folks meet at BYU? Because I've never heard of that happening. I was curious as how they were able to get that to work out.
I think the story goes that my mother's roommate had a crush on my dad, and so my dad kept coming around, only sort of pretending to be interested in that girl, but really just wanted to see more of my mother.
Yes.
So there you have that scandalous story.
And so then how did it happen? You know, it has to occur somehow. It's like, oh yeah, I'm not really here for you. And then there's tears and roommates yell at each other, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think there was a little bit of a fight. My mother, I guess, promised that she would never date my dad because the roommate liked her. But then as soon as he asked her out, that promise was all over.
It was done.
So I don't know. Yeah, that's pretty much all I know. They got married, I think, right before they graduated. I think my dad was, 21? And my mom was 20. My dad might have been 22. And then they took off for the bright lights of San Francisco.
And that's where you were born. Now, are you the oldest of all the kids in your family?
I'm the youngest of two. My mom sort of, my dad had this idea that he wanted to have five kids. And my mom, I think, you know, all the stories come down to you and you're not quite sure if they're exactly true. But the story goes, she told him if he wanted five kids, he would have to marry someone else.
Yeah.
He couldn't do it.
Yeah, she lays it down. Good for your mom.
Yeah, so two was the most, and I was evidently a very difficult child, so that definitely cemented the decision not to have another one. So I'm the youngest of two. We're only 11 months apart. Both of us are 42 years old right now. My brother will turn 43 next month.
Jeez, okay. So pretty close with your brother, and was he the model perfect child?
Yes, indeed he was. He still kind of is. And I was a bit more, I mean, I was a really good kid. I never really got in trouble, but I was always like a willful child, and he's much more of a rule follower.
So
we were really close growing up.
So was it, were you oil to his water then? Is that kind of where you felt like you needed to be?
Well, no, I mean, my mom always laughed that she only had one kid. We just came out in two separate bodies. Like, he's super math and science and structure and rules, and I'm like sleeping in and have cereal for dinner and figure out how to always have a job where I don't have to get up before 10 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So, and obviously I'm an artistic type, and I sort of rebel against the 9-to-5 notion of life.
It raises the question, when you say cereal for breakfast, what's your cereal?
Oh, gosh, I'll do anything. I am a big proponent of the multigrain Cheerios at the moment.
Okay, so a little healthier. I was hoping for like a Lucky Charms or something like that.
No, I mean, we do have to think about longevity these days.
And longevity and Lucky Charms, the two shall never mix?
They just don't mix, exactly.
So pretty close to your brother then, sounds like, born and raised in the Bay Area. What's that like, being a member of the church in the Bay Area?
Well, I don't know. I was born there and then raised in Seattle. But I don't know. Being a Mormon in Seattle was probably a lot like being a Mormon anywhere else outside of Utah. You know, we went to seminary in the morning. There were probably, I don't know, three or four wards in my town. So there were plenty of Mormon kids around, but we certainly weren't the minority, or we certainly weren't majority at school. But it was fun, you know. We did church basketball, we did seminary, we did the same old things, everything everyone else does. Mormon campouts, the whole
deal. Do you get, I don't think you get it as much West Coast, because it seems like we're a little bit more prominent, but did you get still a lot of the, well, you're a cult and you're horns and all that stuff that you kind of hear about from our East Coast friends, or no, not so much?
You know, I don't remember getting too much of that. I mean, I had friends, obviously, who thought our devout lifestyle was stifling or weird, but at the time, I didn't feel like I was missing out on much. I had great friends, and we had a lot of fun, and, you know, Mormon style fun, and I didn't feel like I needed to, you know, smoke weed and go to, like, house parties in order to have a good time in high school, so... I didn't feel persecuted as a member of the church at all.
Girls camp? Did you do the girls camp?
I did the girls camp. Maybe 1 or 2 years. I don't know. I'm much of a camper, so I went because it was fun, but then, you know, pretty soon you realize you have to, like, clean the outhouses and stuff, and I was like, no, I think I'm maybe finished here.
You're like, maybe I don't have to do this. Maybe I actually don't have to clean the outhouses. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe someone else can do that.
So that gets us through high school. Then what happened? Then what do we got going on?
I went to Brigham Young University. I studied English teaching. I became a high school teacher. I did that until I was like 28.
Now, hang on, hold on. You're trying to go too fast. Let's slow it up a little bit. So, an English teacher, though, that sounds to me like that's an up early, you know, 7 a.m. teaching kid kind of job. That doesn't seem like that would be a fit based on what you've already said.
It's true. It was sort of terrible. After 7 years, I still never got used to it. And the funny thing is I was still devoutly Mormon, and I got called into the principal's office and was accused of coming to school hungover all the time because it was just so miserable and tired every day. So I never, ever got used to the early mornings. I like the active teaching. I really love my kids, but I kind of always have this feeling that I was selling myself short. I had this dream of being a writer. And I thought, for whatever reason, that because there wasn't a creative writing program offered at the time at Brigham Young University, I don't know if there is now, that wasn't a viable option for a Mormon girl. I figured if whatever career path you were sort of supposed to have would be offered at a Mormon college. So I gave up on my artistic dream for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, I like teaching and I like books, and so I'll be a high school teacher. But I always kind of felt like there was this other thing that I was sort of more called to do. I felt more, I just kind of felt like my soul reaching for this artistic dream. And so at like 28, I decided to go to maybe 29, decided to go to graduate school, and I got my MFA in creative writing from Bennington College in Vermont, and became a waitress and
wait a minute
wrote poems.
Oh, so you could have some money. That's why you became a waitress. I was trying to make the connection there. It's like, I don't know how creative writing and waitressing, but similar, I guess, to those folks who want to be actors. They go, what can I do that's going to make me some money and allow me some free time?
Exactly. Time and money. It's a great job for people in the arts.
I got to ask you this. Was it really a situation where you got sat down in the principal's office and he's like, are you drinking? Or were you just being exaggerative?
No, I was not being exaggerative. No, my principal, she accused me of coming to school hungover and gave me a big lecture about it. So we had a big talk about whether or not she, I don't know, it was really frustrating. My job began to really not go well for a couple years, and that was one of the things that was frustrating to me. I felt like I was always being called down and punished for things that were preposterous and untrue.
Like what else?
I don't know. I think I got accused of dressing inappropriately, which was super funny because I wore like my church clothes to work. I would wear like pencil skirts and knee-high boots and like cardigans, and for whatever reason that was considered too sexy. I mean, it was just like ridiculous. So the good news is the job went poorly because I had this other dream, and I probably would not have done it if I hadn't been so miserable teaching. And so I really wanted my life to center around being a writer, and that was my opportunity.
So you go and get your MFA at Bennington. Where is that at?
It's in Vermont.
Okay, Vermont. Yeah,
they have a law residency program where you can live anywhere and go to a residency twice a year for 10 days in Vermont. And besides that, you live wherever you live and you communicate with your teachers via telephone and you send work back and forth. And it was a great way for me to figure out how to be a writer in my real life. I didn't want to, like, go on campus and have a fake sort of sense of how much time I would have to write and how much energy I would have to write. And then after I got my degree, not know how to, you know, work it into making a living, because I don't know many writers who can pay their bills that way.
So as you were doing that, you still stayed in Seattle?
I stayed in Seattle for the first year, and then the second year I moved to the Cayman Islands.
Oh, wow.
I sort of, yeah, at this time I was sort of having a bit of a life crisis. And now when I look back, I feel like, you know, I wasn't ready to leave my faith, but my life was kind of spiraling in a lot of ways, and I didn't like where things were headed. And a lot of, there were just a lot of people talking to me about what they thought my life should be like. And it was in conflict in some ways with what I felt like my life should be like. And I think I just packed up and sold everything so I just had some peace and quiet and try and figure out what it was I really wanted.
I'm curious, because you get graduated, you have your English degree from BYU, and you're able essentially to get out of BYU without being married. Were there thoughts where you're like, oh man, that didn't happen right for me? Or were you just like, no, you know, I'm on a track, I'm on a plan?
Yeah, I felt like college was too soon to get married. I felt like I was just getting started with my life. And so I didn't date much in college. I've never really had much luck dating LDS men.
Just because they, why?
I don't know. I mean, there are theories. I'm not sure which theories they are.
Throw them out. Let's hear it.
LDS men tend to find them offensive. So the thing I most often heard was that I'm intimidating, which I think is ridiculous, because I don't think men are automatically intimidated by a woman who's smart and who's opinionated and who's interesting.
No, we like them dumb. We like them dumb, though. We like our women. We LDS men, man, if you've got a brain, forget it. We like them dumb.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But I'm tall. Sometimes that is a lot for guys to handle. You know, if your lady is like 6'2" in heels, like, I don't know. I didn't really want to get married when I was in college, so that was probably a lot of it. I never really wanted to have children, so there's a really big one. I don't know many LDS people who feel comfortable saying on a date when the topic of how many kids do you want inevitably comes up. I don't know many people who feel like it's okay to say, I don't know if I want any. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of probably the deal breaker from the beginning of a lot of relationships. But
so you felt that way, though, even back in college, the fact that you didn't want children. How come?
I don't know if there's a reason for it. I mean, I kept waiting for the clock to tick, for the biological urge to set in. I feel like most people want kids, whether or not you're Mormon, whether or not if you're a man, if you're a woman, whatever.
Yeah.
I feel like most people want children. And so I kept waiting and sort of hoping for that to kick in, and it didn't at 20, but I was only 20, and who cares if you don't want kids at 20? It's pretty soon.
Then you're smart. Then that's what that is. You're smart if you don't want kids at 20.
And then I was 25, and then I was 30, and then I was, at that point, I started to realize that this was going to be a problem in an LDS relationship. And so I never had LDS relationships, and then I couldn't really date outside of the church because of, you know, the law of chastity is tough for a lot of people to take outside of the church. I don't know many men who will date a woman for as long as it takes to get married without pursuing any kind of sexual relationship. Mm-hmm. So dating was really sort of impossible within the church and impossible outside of the church, and I became pretty isolated.
Were there anyone in the time while you're teaching in your, you know, mid to late 20s, was there ever a time where you had dated a Mormon or non-Mormon person and it worked out for any length of time?
When I was like 26, I had a boyfriend. He features prominently in my book. And he he wanted to get married, and I kind of thought that I did too, until, you know, we started, suddenly the conversations turned from if to when, and I started feeling a little panicky, and I don't know if it was that I didn't want to get married to him or because I didn't want to get married at all quite yet. I really felt like everything I dreamed about my whole life was just sort of starting to happen, and I was a little bit terrified that if I got married, suddenly most of my life would take place inside of a house, and that felt scary and wrong to me.
So was this guy that you were dating, was he LDS?
No, he was Catholic.
Okay.
And he was respectful of my LDS standards, and you know, when you're waiting until marriage to have a physical relationship, things move along really quickly. And so we dated for just over a year, and then the conversations were pretty serious about, like, you know, what's going to happen next. And I just, it didn't work out. So I went on to other things.
So now this puts you at about, we're looking at about 28, 29 years old. You're living in the Cayman Islands. You're finishing up your Master's of Fine Arts. Let's go there. Then what?
Well, I mean, the island was a fantastic, beautiful, wonderful experience. I was there for about a year, and I took up scuba diving, and which was really, became kind of a spiritual outlet for me. There's something about being underwater where you can't hear anything except the beating of your own heart and sort of the thoughts in your head. It became like a really beautiful spiritual place for me, in a way that church has sort of not been inspiring for a long time, and not been sort of, it hadn't felt like a positive or loving place for a while. And so I really started to seek that element of spirit that I was missing.
But all the while still going to church? Were you active in your wards, both in Seattle and in the Cayman Islands?
Yeah, there was a little yellow church in the Cayman Islands, and I went there on Sundays. And, you know, I had just felt things starting to crumble for a long time, but I was really clinging. You know, we're taught that only after the trial of your faith will you be rewarded. So, so I just assumed that I just needed to get through the trial and everything would be better. And so I sought solace in scuba diving and in writing, and I built this kind of really nice community of writers outside the church who kind of understood my desires a little bit more. And I figured all that stuff that wasn't going well would be temporary. And I tried to change everything. I changed where I lived. I changed my friends. I changed what I did for a living, hoping that everything would all start to come together. And, you know, you sort of have this idea that you're going to wake up one day and you're going to meet a guy and everything is going to be better.
Yeah, that'll solve it. That'll solve it.
But that's a pretty prevalent thought, I think, in an LDS community. Like, if I meet the right person and we get married, then everything's going to be on the right track. I think especially for older singles, that, I mean, it's not uncommon to think that a lot of your problems will be solved if you find the right relationship, if you get married. And so,
Let me say this. I think that it's very prevalent and very common. I just, unfortunately, don't find it to be very accurate.
Yeah, I didn't either. So, yeah, so I spent a lot of time diving. I wrote poems. In a lot of ways, I found myself moving toward a life that felt much more fulfilling to me. But the problem was, as that was happening, a lot of certain of my spiritual beliefs were starting to crumble, and that was really incredibly terrifying for me. So I had those two opposites fighting with each other at that time.
Okay. Well, coming back in the third block, I want to talk about some of those, maybe those spiritual beliefs that started crumbling, and then we'll get into everything about your book coming up here in the third block of the Cultural Hall.
Sidewinder Media was named as one of Utah's top photographers by In This Week magazine and is a winner of several awards for fine art, portrait, and event photography. Sidewinder Media has been professionally photographing everything from wildlife to headshots for over 10 years. Sidewinder Media has the experience and the knowledge to capture your special occasion or portrait the way you want it. They also film and edit music or product videos and do simple ads for Facebook or websites. Email them at sidewindermedia@gmail.com or call Rusty at 801-941-5576 to book your shoot today.
All right, back here in the third block, it's author Nicole Hardy, author of the book Confessions of a Latter-day Virgin, a memoir. And where we picked, where we left off was talking. You noticed that kind of some spiritual questions started to come in, and you noticed life was crumbling. What were some of those questions? Was it like doctrinal things, or was it, I thought I was supposed to be happy, and I'm not really happy?
No, I mean, I think the issue of motherhood was a really difficult one for me. I think, you know, as a woman in the church, you're sort of taught that your birthright and your divine purpose is to be a mother, and you're considered mother even if you don't have children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember a conference talk where I think it was Gordon B. Hinckley who said, you know, like Eve, your motherhood began before you were born, and things like that were always really difficult for me because, as I said before, I kept waiting to want children, and I sort of never did. And it caused a rift in two ways. One, it sort of just separated me from all the other women of the church. I felt like all of our conversations and so many of our lessons were about how to be a good mother, how to be a good example for your family, and how to be of life and how to contribute in those ways to the partnership in a marriage. And if you don't feel like any of those things are actually who you are or are actually what you want, it's sort of a little bit terrifying. And I remember, you know, the bishop's wife came to me one time. I'm maybe 33 years old at this point, and we were teaching a primary class and stacking up the chairs afterward, and she said, oh, it must be so difficult for you not to have children of your own. What a blessing it is to have these primary children in your life. And I said, actually, it's not that difficult. I've never really wanted children. And I meant to sort of put her at ease. I didn't need her to be worrying about me in that way. And she sort of stepped back and said, if you were truly living the gospel, God would bless you with that desire.
Yay, I love when members say stuff like that. Ugh.
And so the problem really became that, and I'm sure other single people in the church have experienced a lot of similar things. There becomes a point at which people assume there's something wrong with you, or you're not worthy if you're not living the life that is prescribed for you, and so church no longer began to feel like a place of refuge. It really began to feel like a place where I had to defend myself. And that's never particularly pleasant. It's not a place where you can't have your guard up all the time and feel the Spirit.
Yeah, so, church or otherwise. Clearly, church or otherwise, I don't think anyone wants to go, well, you know, I'm going to be, you know, people are going to be coming at me for being different in this situation. All right, let's go to this situation right now. I'm excited. No, I don't. You know, church or otherwise.
Yeah, so culturally it was really difficult because no one really got it. And, you know, I was pursuing life as a writer, and I was publishing poems. And
who are you publishing columns for?
Oh, small literary journals. Probably nothing anyone would hear of. But to me, it was a huge accomplishment. I had spent, you know, probably 5 or 6 years, like, in school and studying poetry and reading, and I was finally starting to get published, and it really felt like I was coming home to this thing that I really felt like I was meant to do.
Mm-hmm. Kind of coming into your own. Cool.
Yeah, and I was always always talked to as if that was a hobby and or something to keep me occupied. And so those things were incredibly frustrating. I never felt like I was really being taken seriously as a grown-up or as an artist or as a woman who sort of knew her mind. So culturally, those things were difficult, but doctrinally, I had a difficult time, too. I didn't want to be told every time I went to church that I was a mother when I knew that that actually wasn't true, and to be promised in the afterlife that I would have children, and that what I should sort of, that's what should comfort me, because I don't get to have that here. But the thing that was held out as balm didn't make me feel better. I had some issues with the way that the church views homosexuals.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're taught to believe that it's the complete and total and absolute truth, if one thing suddenly comes untrue in your opinion,
mm-hmm.
or in your heart or whatever, then all of it can suddenly start to unravel. And that was a really hard time. I did not expect to ever leave my faith. I didn't want to ever leave my faith. But I couldn't see a way to thrive in that community anymore. And I couldn't see a way to really feel like myself, given the life I was supposed to lead as an LDS woman.
So you're going to church, you're essentially unhappy. People are telling you, oh, you should be happy. Live it more righteously. What eventually ended up happening then?
Well, it's so hard because it's not really quite as linear as that.
Mm-hmm.
I think moving away to the island was part of the response to that. I'm like, I just need to get away from these voices and figure out if I'm feeling this way just because there are so many people talking at me all the time about what I should be doing and what I should be feeling. And there are theories about why I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do or why I'm not feeling what I'm supposed to feel. And so that year off, I think, helped solidify a lot of things. I just realized I wanted to travel the world, and I wanted to write poems, and I wanted to remove myself from the kind of fellowship that really just felt stifling. And I realized that I wanted to be a part of a community that really loved and accepted every one of God's children. And the placing of people into categories is something that I feel like the church community really does. Either you're a single adult, or you're a young single adult, or you're a mid-single, or you're a less active member, or mm-hmm. you're, it's just like there's so many categories for people. And I wanted sort of a larger and more inclusive community. And so I came back from the island, and it took a few years, but eventually I felt like I had to move away from church, and that was awful and something that I was afraid would devastate my family. I was afraid that it would negate my entire identity.
Mm-hmm.
I think the beauty of the church is that it lets you know exactly who you are and exactly what your life is or should be or will be. And then when suddenly all of that is up for question, it puts you into a really terrifying place. Like, will I be able to still have a relationship with God? Will I still be able to have a relationship with my parents? Will I still know who I am if I take this step to leave? Will I make my life worse? Am I simply weak?
I get that a lot, where you just go, well, maybe if I just would have been a little tougher, maybe if I, yeah, that feeling of, did I really do all? I get that.
Yeah, it's really difficult to always be told when you're struggling that it's just a matter of weakness. And I don't look at things in terms of strength and weakness anymore. I mean, this woman wrote to me the other day about my book, and she said, oh, our lives could have been so different. I could have been you if I had been stronger, or you could have been me if you were weaker. And I don't even know exactly what she was referring to, which choices or which actions or whatever. And she said, but look at us now, both of us, you know, are living lives that we want to live and feeling happier. And, you know, we have like the happy ending. And I don't know. I wrote back and I said, it's difficult for me to see things in such black and white. I'm not sure anyone's ending is perfectly happy. I'm not sure anyone is simply weak or simply strong. I mean, I think all of us are just doing our best to sort of survive our personal tragedies and live good and productive lives, you know?
So when you come back, are your folks, by the way, still active in the LDS Church?
Yeah, my parents are still active. My brother is. He's married with kids. All of them are very active members, and so that, as you can imagine, makes certain situations tricky.
Mm-hmm.
But they, yeah, I mean, my parents are doing their best to be supportive. I have to sit down with them and say, I'm taking a break from the church. And I said it that way because I was too afraid to say, I think I need to leave. And I said, you know, I would have done it years sooner if I wasn't afraid of you loving me less or of destroying our family. You know, my parents worked really, really hard to build this beautiful life that neither of them had.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave my brother and I a pretty idyllic childhood and worked really hard to make a perfect family. And so to come to them and say, I don't want this thing that you dedicated your life to giving me, it felt really personal.
Mm-hmm.
Is it
similar? I've heard some people, and you obviously wouldn't know if it is exactly like this, but some people will say it's a thing like they have to make the decision to almost come out to their parents.
Yeah, I have had several other people who have come out in the traditional way that we think of coming out tell me that mine is also a coming out story. And I didn't really think of it that way, but it seems like there are the same fears and the same conflicts in certain ways. You know, I had to say to my family, I'm doing this thing. I know that you think it's the worst decision I could possibly make. I know that it means to you that you're going to be together in the eternities and I won't be there with you. I mean, for me to say I'm leaving the church, that's what they hear, that I choose not to be with them.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that's heartbreaking.
How did they do with it?
In the moment, not particularly well. I mean, we had a conversation and there was a lot of weeping. And at the end of it, I had to say to them, this is what I'm doing and I still want to be part of this family. So I hope that you'll love me and that you'll keep me, but if you give me a hard time, the only thing that's going to happen is that we'll grow apart.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, if you give me a hard time, it's not going to change my mind. It's not going to make me suddenly come closer to the church.
Let me ask you this. Was it one of those things like you see on TV where you're rehearsing it in your mind where you're like, Mom, Dad, I'm leaving the LDS. No, that's not right. That doesn't sound right. Let me try that again. Mom, Dad, I can't get, you know, was it that kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't know if I had a script planned. And I put it off for a couple months, and then I felt like I was sort of lying to them. Like every time I went to their house for dinner on Sunday, they thought that I had just come from church. And so that was tricky because I didn't want to not have integrity. I didn't want to live a double life. I didn't want to lie to my family. So I don't know exactly even... It's been a long time. I don't know if I rehearsed the conversation, but I do remember thinking, how much do I have to tell them about what's gone wrong? How much do they need to know? Because it's never been my intention to try to talk anyone else out of their faith.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I wanted them to retain everything beautiful about the gospel that they have found in it. So I was just really debating about how deep I needed to get into, you know, the doctrinal issues that I no longer believe were true. So it was a really terrible time. And, you know, it's been almost 7 years since then. And I will say that for the most part, my family has been really loving and really supportive. And they came to my book launch party, which was a big move that I don't know if I expected it or not. I really hoped that they would come. I hope I've written a book that Mormons can read. I know that, you know, anything that's not directly in support of the church is often interpreted as anti-Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've written an anti-Mormon book. It would disappoint me if it was interpreted that way. But I think the issues of celibacy and the issues of singlehood in the church and the issues of being a woman in the church are sometimes more complicated than a lot of members are able to consider. So,
let me ask you this. You said that your parents initially maybe didn't do so well about receiving it. What, you know, for other people that are listening, maybe they have an opportunity where someone is going to come to them or has come to them or you know, how would you have liked them to react, or what kind of advice would you give to people who have someone in their life who they care about as much as parents to a daughter to be able to react?
Yeah, I mean, I think really they they did the best they could do. I mean, I think at some point my mom just had to like get up and go cry alone in her room. Mm-hmm. But they listened to me talk, and there was no yelling, and they assured me that they still loved me and they always would. And but it was just like a really terrible situation. You know, I have other friends who you talked about the coming out story before and sort of the similarities of those kinds of discussions. And I have a friend who had the coming out talk to her parents, and her dad sort of flipped out and left in the middle of it because he suddenly needed to do some work on the roof of the house, and then was distracted and fell off the roof.
Oh my gosh.
So like at least no one fell off the roof. Yeah. When I went, so, you know, I mean, those are probably the extremes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, no one lectured me and no one told me I was going to be punished for eternity. You know, it didn't get ugly. It was just really sad and really heartbreaking.
So
I guess my advice for, I mean, I don't know, it's difficult for me to try to give people advice, but to just hang on to the basic thing, which is that you all love each other. And, you know, if the conversations start from there and come from a place of love, those things hopefully can't go too far wrong.
So was it at that point that you decided to write Confessions of a Latter-day Virgin, or when did that take place?
Oh, no, it was years later. I didn't ever really expect that I would write this story. I think a lot of people go through it. Some lady on Twitter last night just said, like, I'm so irritated that Nicole Hardy got a book deal for just going through what every Mormon girl goes through. And I was thinking, well, maybe it has something to do with the fact that I'm a writer.
Yeah.
And maybe it also has something to do with the fact that no one else is talking about this. I mean, I think it took me a really long time to feel like I was allowed to tell this story. I mean, I think we live in sort of a culture of silence. If we disagree with something, we're often told to be quiet and to pray about it. And so it's difficult to feel like you have permission to talk about the stories that would be considered failures. And I had to be ready for people to judge me and for to call me a lot of horrible names and to still be okay with the fact that I'm just telling you what happened and I'm telling you what I felt and the ways that it went wrong in ways that I did not ever expect that it would. So it took probably, I left the church when I was 35.
Now, when you say left, did you have your name removed from the church?
You know, I haven't done that, only because it seems like a lot of effort to figure out how to do it. And also, I think it would devastate my parents in a way that would be a little bit unforgivable.
Uh-huh.
I think the thing that helps them get through this is the belief that I'll change my mind someday and then I'll come back.
Sure, because you never know what might happen. You might wake up.
Yeah,
you might wake up one day and be like, hey, you know what, that Mormon church thing, sure,
why not?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I can never rule anything out. So, and I don't have a hateful or bitter relationship with the church. I definitely appreciated a lot of things about my faith and about my upbringing. So I would probably be considered an inactive member.
Okay.
At this point. So so I made that decision at 35, and then I wrote the book. The last scene of the book ends at my 40th birthday, so I must have been like 40, 41 when I started writing the book. So it took like 5 years to get, I mean, I really feel like I went through a really painful divorce. I mean, I feel like all the emotions that you go through and all the ways that you feel kind of destroyed by that and betrayed and just sad and devastated. I feel like I had to go through all of those things before I could really write beautiful paragraphs. But, you know,
how is the book run? Is it like a chronological, then this happened and then this happened, or is it like, let's talk about the subject of sex and then there's various experiences of that? How does it read?
The structure of the book is such that it starts with the prologue of the church starts with me sort of having a really intense talk with my mother. I think I'm 33 years old in the prologue, and it starts with my mother telling me that sex isn't everything. And then And so we kind of have this discussion where she's not really able to understand how sex, like the sanctions against it, the not being able to have it, the ways that it, that I'm not able to connect with other people or with my body or with my emotions, because the only way that I was able to sort of be chased for as long as I did is I sort of willed myself into a depression. Like if I couldn't feel my feelings, then I would be able to resist, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I got into this, a pretty dark place. And that was the only way I could survive. And so my mom obviously couldn't understand that. And she couldn't understand how the wanting of sex sort of influences every aspect of your life.
Sure.
At that age. And so, and it's not just, you know, this carnal desire. It's just that we're relational beings and we're physical beings. And very few people who talk about being chased have had to be chased into their 30s or 40s or 50s.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, and so anyway, we start off having this really intense conversation, and then that there's only like three or four pages of that, and then the book immediately flips back when I'm 12 years old, and then I'm in my first young women's lesson on the law of chastity, and then it skips ahead, but fairly chronologically, from age 12 to age 40, and kind of follows my journey of faith and my journey through my family and journey of sort of defining how I'm going to be a woman if I'm not going to be a wife and a mother, and also the journey of sort of coming to writing. And I feel like those four things are like the threads that pull all the way through the book.
So,
hello?
Yeah. No, you're fine. Sorry. I'm just trying to think of where I want to go with it next. So within the book, then it's just going to what that woman said on Twitter. I mean, it kind of is, though. It sounds like a pretty familiar story for LDS women.
I'm not sure what happened to me or the things I felt are particularly unique, but I think that's the beauty. I mean, I don't know. I don't know many 36-year-old virgins, and so that aspect of it might be unique, but struggles with faith and struggles with identity are not unique. And that's the beauty of literature. We're mm-hmm. all of us trying to figure out, trying to explore the human experience a little bit. And so if every book that was ever written had to have a story that was ever written before, there would be no book on a bookshelf.
There would be five right? books, and we... Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that my story is representative of a lot of people's stories, and hopefully that's what will draw them to the book.
Well, and what I love is what you said earlier, is that there's not a lot of people talking about it. And so, you know,
no,
perhaps with you being able to be in a place where you, you know, there's almost safety from not being within the church, that they don't have to worry about, you know, ramifications for things that you might say as far as your membership goes, because... You know, that's not something that, you know, that you're too terribly worried about.
You know, a lot of people have asked, you know, if I've been disfellowshipped or if I've been excommunicated, and I'm not quite sure. I'm not convinced I've said anything that's even deserving of that. I say I loved growing up Mormon. I really had faith. My faith started to crumble. I was devastated by that. I had to make a new life. And so I'm not sure that any of those things are the worst things anyone has ever said in the world. Or so, like I said before, on purpose, I tried to write a book that LDS people could read. I'm not bashing the church. I'm not angry. I'm not bitter. I'm disappointed and I'm sad. And there are moments of anger and frustration, obviously. But I think what I would really like is if people could consider an experience like mine that is not that uncommon in the church,
mm-hmm.
but members don't often consider it a valid experience. I think that since singles are so often segregated, for lack of a better word, concerns aren't taken to be concerns of the church. They're sort of, our problems are also kept separate. And people in the family wards don't often think that they should be concerned or need to be concerned about what's happening in those other wards. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, that's a mistake.
Well, yeah, because I think Jesus said love everyone, not just the people in your ward.
Yeah, that is how it's supposed to be. And I get the theory behind a singles ward, but I just think in practice, in practice, it seems that it does more to alienate us from each other than to bring us together.
Let me ask you, because obviously now you've been out of the church, I think you said about 7 years.
Yes.
How has that been?
I think a lot of people want me to say that it's been terrible. They want it all to turn out to be a cautionary tale, but honestly,
warning,
I mean,
don't do what I've done. I left the church, and I wish I could get back. Stay there if you can.
There's no longer anyone in my life who would think to determine my worth based on whether or not I'm married or I have a child.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an incredible relief. I'm surrounded by people who are really loving and creative and interesting and ambitious, and that also feels like an incredible relief. I still feel like I live by a lot of LDS values,
mm-hmm.
and all of my non-member friends do too. I'm still an honest person. I still have integrity. I still, you know, care about taking care of others, and you know,
yeah. You still you still call them non-member friends, so I heard.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
Your audience.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
But yeah, the beauty is that I don't have to think in terms of members and non-members or singles and married. And you know, a lot of my best friends are married couples, and the men are like my brothers, and the women are like my sisters. And I found kind of this new brotherhood and this new sisterhood that feels much more loving and inclusive and accepting. I'm writing books. I'm traveling the world. I'm surrounded by love. I can't think of anything else I can want except a romantic love. Like, I still haven't found that, but I feel really hopeful. And that's something I didn't feel for a really long time when I was in the church. So, yeah, I feel like I'm in a really good place.
Do you, in the book, I'm just curious, based on the title, The Confessions of a Latter-day Virgin, and you talk about how it culminates then at the end on your 40th birthday, do you then talk about, you know, having your experiences with those physically intimate relationships? Obviously not like, and then he grabbed me, you know, that kind of thing, but do you talk about...
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think if you say on the first page of the book that you are a 33-year-old virgin, and people invest all of their time and energy in the book, you have to give them that scene in the end. I mean, like, the reader sort of deserves that payoff. So there are, there is a little bit of sex in the book. I don't think it's too juicy, not too salacious, but definitely, yeah. I mean, there are a few awkward and horrible failed attempts, and it does eventually happen in the end.
Oh,
and,
spoiler! Now I don't even need to read the book. Now I know what happened.
So yeah, those scenes are in the book. I've had people complain that there's not enough sex in the book. I've had people complain that there's too much sex in the book. So people will just have to read to figure out
for them
whether they agree or disagree.
Let me ask you this. Do you find the majority of the people that are reading it are active Latter-day Saints, or are people who are disaffected or just curious about the Mormon Church?
I don't know. If I had to guess based on the letters that I have received, most of my readers are people who have grown up with some kind of religious background.
Not necessarily Mormon?
Not necessarily Mormon, but people who can relate in a lot of ways. But I have gotten letters from Mormon people who are both active and inactive. I've gotten letters from people who aren't religious in any way, and they're curious about the Mormon Church or curious about the virginity part. And many of them have just written to say that they got some sort of new insight, and really lovely as a writer to hear those things coming. back at me, you know?
People can find this book. It's called Confessions of a Latter-day Virgin. And you can find it Amazon. You can find it in any of your bookstores. When did this come out?
It came out in August, and it sold pretty much anywhere books are sold. I've been told that it's at Costco in Ogden. And there's also a Kindle download, an ebook download, and also an audiobook that I've narrated in my very own voice.
Oh, really? Well, so I can hear you telling me about your first sexual experience. That seems uncomfortable.
Well, the good news is I wouldn't really be in the room. I would just be in your headphones.
Yeah. Anything else that we missed? Anything you want to share with people?
I don't think so. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Yeah, we appreciate you having taking a few minutes and being here. We hope that this podcast has nourished and strengthened your body, and that if you weren't healthy enough to listen this week, that you will be healthy enough to listen next week. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat on the back row. We